We move to the third case this morning. Coldwaite versus ALU. Ms. McLaughlin?
Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to start by briefly touching on the jurisdiction issue. This court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal. This is actually a very straightforward analysis. There are three orders that are at issue here. The October 2012 order, in which the district court entered a summary judgment in favor of the defendant on four of the plaintiff's five claims. The January 2013 order, in which the district court withdrew the summary judgment order and granted, in part, plaintiff's motion to reconsider. And then the third decision is in March 2013, where for the first time, the district court granted summary judgment on all five of the plaintiff's claims. So for the purposes of determining jurisdiction in this court need only look to the indisputable fact that the original order, the October 18th order, was not a final order as to all of plaintiff's claims. The district court told us as much. It stated, and I quote, "I overlooked the record of disability theory and ruled only on the regarded as theory," unquote. Rule 54B covers this contingency. It specifically provides that any order or decision, however designated, that doesn't adjudicate, that adjudicates fewer than all claims, does not end the action and can be revised at any time. So the bottom line here is that until the district court ruled on the oversight or corrected the oversight and ruled on the regarded the record of claim, plaintiff had no authority to appeal the decision of the district court. That didn't happen until March, and from that order, a timely appeal was taken. So turning to the substantive issues, we're here today because the district court granted summary judgment to the defendant and found that there were no contested issues of material fact as to whether the defendant refused to allow plaintiff to return to work because of his disability or his perceived disability. This court must reverse that finding because the district court improperly took that decision out of the hands of the jury. In doing so, the district court made three critical errors. It misapplied the summary judgment standards, it misapplied Supreme Court precedent, and it utilized an incorrect analysis with respect to the decision maker. As to my first point, the law is clear and this court knows it backwards and forwards. When it comes to granting summary judgment, the district court must review the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, must draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party, and most importantly, cannot make credibility decisions. Here, the court did it all. The best example of this is in the record is with respect to the medical opinions that were offered by the medical professionals. There are four medical professionals who offered opinions as to whether or not plaintiff was capable of returning to work. The two treating physicians released plaintiff to return to work without any restriction. The physical therapist, in the first instance, said return to work without any restrictions, and then in the second instance, put on a lifting restriction. And then we have defendant's doctor, who determined that there should be a permanent lifting, two permanent restrictions, lifting and repetitive motion. So it's uncontested that these are the opinions of the medical professionals. And they obviously, it's quite clear that they are conflicting opinions that create the material issue of fact that is contested with respect to whether plaintiff can return to work. This contested issue alone is should be enough to sufficient to deny summary judgment, because this is a central, whether plaintiff can return to work is the central issue in this case. A reasonable jury could find that the plaintiff's actual impairment prevented him from returning to work, or could find that he could return to work without a problem. Either way, it's a decision for the jury.
Would you straighten something out for me? This is the sequence, because by the time we get to this third motion and whatever, when the decision's made, this is under 60B review, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's a pretty tough one to climb over. And going back to what you originally, I guess what you're saying is that your motion to reconsider is under Rule 59. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
The original motion to reconsider that was brought was misdesignated. That is the case. It was misdesignated. What our position is that there's case law that indicates that if a motion to reconsider is misdesignated to be considered as a Rule 60 motion, it doesn't affect the time to appeal, et cetera. But that doesn't have any effect in this particular situation because, in fact, there was no time to appeal. The decision that we were asking to have reconsidered was not final. And Rule 54B is very explicit that, however, an order is designated, whatever the intent of the district court was, if it doesn't rule, if the order does not terminate the entire case, that's
not a final judgment, what you're saying?
It's not a final judgment, yes. The October 18th was never a decision, was never a final judgment. So it could not have prevented the plaintiff from asking for a motion to reconsider. It wouldn't even the court could have.
You can only have a notice of appeal if there's a final judgment, right?
Of course. We didn't file a notice of appeal in November. It was a motion to amend the judgment because we brought to the court's attention the fact that there was this omission, that it wasn't final.
Okay, so instead of appealing, you just filed a Rule 60B motion.
Correct.
Challenge.
To correct it.
Right.
And to bring to the court the oversight.
No, there isn't any. There's actually no such thing as a motion to reconsider in the rules. But you wanted it amended to show it was fine.
Correct. I want to point out to you, with respect to the first point that we've made, that the district court found that my client was a liar. This is an impermissible credibility assessment. In its January decision, the court stated that plaintiff had made, quote, false portrayal to his job requirements, unquote. And then went on to say that he could have very well have made the same false portrayals to his treating physicians. There is nothing in the record to support that conclusion whatsoever. And then in its March decision, the one that is on appeal right now, the court stated very clearly that plaintiff's case consisted of, quote, plainly incredible statements, unquote. So it really cannot be reasonably disputed that finding plaintiff is a liar, particularly on this record where there is so many disputed facts, is a credibility determination. And these impermissible inferences and credibility assessments permeate the entire record and the court's legal analysis. With respect to our second point, with the misapplication of the law, in the decision that is being appealed here, the March decision, the court took the position that it was the third prong of the disability test, that plaintiff could not prove that defendant took the adverse action because of the plaintiff's disability. Ironically, 2 months earlier, in its January opinion, the court stated, and I quote, defendant has not offered any non-impairment-based reason for terminating plaintiff. Now I ask, how can it be both ways? It can't. That's the answer. And certainly, if a judge can find that it could be both ways, a reasonable jury could find either way as well. And therefore, summary judgment must be denied. The major flaw in the district court's analysis, or the legal analysis, in this but-for causation, I believe, is the misuse of the term discriminatory intent. The court uses the term discriminatory intent, discriminatory bias, prohibited animus, discriminatory animus, and it all interchangeably. And it's all used by the court in a manner that clearly indicates that regardless of whether the defendant was mistaken about the plaintiff's disability, it is also incumbent upon the plaintiff to show that the defendant took the action it did because it held some kind of ill will or hostility, dislike, animosity towards the plaintiff. This is borne out also by the court repeatedly interchanging and stating that plaintiff cannot prove defendant took the action because of the prohibited animus, rather than correctly stating the law, defendant cannot prove that defendant took the action because of the disability. So
you're in your rebuttal time, ma'am. It's okay with me.
Okay. Well, I will just finish this particular section and save the rest for rebuttal. I would suggest to you that the court cannot reconcile the use of these terms with the Supreme Court's holding in Sutton that the employer's honestly held but mistaken belief about the plaintiff's impairment is all the plaintiff needs to prove. In this instance, the district court's analysis is just simply wrong. Animosity, ill will towards the plaintiff is not necessary to show that the employer's actions were intentional or that they were discriminatory. And I will stop there and save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dishman?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Neil Dishman of Jackson Lewis on behalf of the defendant appellee, Alcatel Lucent. The district court's October 18th, 2012 judgment was a final and appealable judgment. Alcatel-Lucent moved for summary judgment in full. The district court entered an opinion, which it concluded by saying that it was granting Alcatel-Lucent's motion, and I quote, on all counts. The district court also entered a judgment on that date, in which it said that, quote, this action, close quote, was decided for Alcatel-Lucent on summary judgment. It also entered a minute order on that date, stating that the civil case had been terminated. All of that language is unequivocal. The October 18th, 2012 judgment, which is the only judgment that the district court ever entered in this case, was final and appealable. So Mr. Coldwaite had 30 days to appeal that judgment. He did not do so. Alternatively, he had 28 days to file a timely motion under Rule 52 and/or Rule 59 to amend the judgment. He did not do that either. Instead, he filed what he branded as a Rule 52 or 59 motion, 29 days, one day late, after the 28-day deadline. Now, the law of the circuit's unequivocal that such a motion, an untimely Rule 52-59 motion, is to be treated as a motion under Rule 60B. So as a result of his actions after the October 18th, 2012 judgment was entered, Mr. Coldwaite has limited this court's review to whether or not the district court abused its discretion in denying that what was effectively a Rule 60B motion. That turns out to be dispositive of this appeal. The reason that it's dispositive is because Mr. Coldwaite has made no arguments at all, either in the district court or in this court, that even attempt to meet Rule 60B's high standards for altering or amending a judgment. Rule 60B allows for relief from a judgment only for extraordinary reasons, newly discovered evidence, fraud, things of that nature. There is no evidence and no argument on that point here. Mr. Coldwaite only argued, first of all, in his motion below, and second of all in this court, that the judge made routine errors. The judge, in his view, got the facts wrong, misunderstood his theory of the case, applied the incorrect legal standard, made improper credibility judgments, and so forth. Rule 60B does not provide for any relief for those reasons. That means that the court should, given the limited nature of its review, summarily affirm the judgment below, as it did in Cash versus Illinois Division of Mental Health and a number of other cases that we cited. Should the court disagree with that and turn to the merits of the case, I'll also address the merits, and in particular, I want to address Mr. Coldwaite's failure to show that he was terminated because of any protected status under the statutes under which he's brought suit. Now, counsel said a few minutes ago that what she termed the central issue in this case is whether or not Mr. Coldwaite was able to return to work. That is not the central issue in the case. The central issue in the case is whether or not there's any evidence that Alcatel-Lucent terminated him because intentionally discriminated against him because of what it regarded as a disability. Mr. Coldwaite chose from the outset of this case to pursue a claim of intentional discrimination. As the district court ultimately ruled, he uncovered no evidence below to support that claim. So what he's trying to do here, in order to get around that hole in his case, is to ask this court for a fairly extraordinary result. He's telling the court that he should be able to hold Alcatel-Lucent liable for intentional discrimination without any evidence of intent to discriminate. And he tries to mask that radical result that he's asking for by claiming in his briefs that there's some confusion in the law on this point that he needs this court to resolve. There's no confusion. The law is quite clear. In particular, I want to focus on this court's decision in Timmons versus General Motors, which is on all fours with this case. Timmons was a case, like here, where there was a good faith dispute between the employer and the employee as to whether or not the employee was still physically capable of performing his job. The court upheld summary judgment for the employer in that case based on a key distinction that's also present in this case. This court said in Timmons that summary judgment was proper because, among other reasons, there was not, and I quote, any evidence suggesting that GM put him on leave because of his disability rather than his inability to perform certain critical aspects of his job, end quote. The court then went on to note in support of this conclusion that GM acted on its, quote, legitimate concerns about Timmons' ability, close quote, to do his job, and that Timmons produced no evidence that, quote, GM did not actually have these concerns, close quote. That's the key distinction that Mr. Coldwaite wants to evade in this case. Timmons and some of the other cases we've cited hold that terminating an employee because of an actual or perceived disability is unlawful. This is to be distinguished from terminating an employee based on an honestly held belief that he is no longer capable of performing his job. All the evidence in the Timmons case and all of the evidence in this case point towards the latter, an honestly held belief that he could no longer perform his job functions. That's why summary judgment was warranted in the Timmons case and why it was also warranted here.
What do you make of the argument that he was making determinations on as to the credibility of witnesses?
So I believe plaintiff gave two examples of that. The first example is the issue of what Mr. Coldwaite said to the physical therapist, Jonathan Erickson, that ALU sent him to for a functional capacity evaluation. The district court below did not determine on its own that Mr. Coldwaite was a liar, as counsel put it. Mr. Coldwaite, as deposition, implicitly admitted that he misled the physical therapist. It was undisputed below that he told the physical therapist at the FCE that his job required no overhead lifting. He admitted under oath at his deposition that his job does involve at least some amount of overhead lifting. So that was not the judge deciding, I don't find the plaintiff's testimony credible. That was the judge recognizing that the plaintiff had, in essence, admitted that he had made a false statement to the physical therapist. The district court also made a reference in its opinion, which counsel alluded to, about plainly incredible statements. I believe, if I recall correctly, the plainly incredible statement that the district court was referring to was actually a statement in plaintiff's brief below, in which the plaintiff said, essentially, we dispute that the job required overhead lifting, but he does admit that it requires a little bit of overhead lifting. So that was the plainly incredible statement that I believe the court was referring to. Virtually all of Mr. Coldwaite's evidence, both below and in this court, is geared towards the idea that Alcatel-Lucent made a mistake here. It made a wrong decision. So, for example, he wants to second-guess various aspects of Dr. Perez's analysis and opinions that he gave. Mr. Coldwaite claims that he finds the restrictions that Dr. Pera ordered for him to be vague. He wants to quibble about the definition of what does and does not count as overhead lifting, and so forth. In other words, he's telling this court he thinks he can convince a jury that Alcatel-Lucent got his decision wrong, made a mistake. What that means under the law of the circuit is that he cannot win. That's the lesson of Timmons, that's the lesson of Yindy, and a number of other cases we cited in our brief. Yindy in particular puts this most in the most pithy fashion. Mistakes are not unlawful in a claim of intentional discrimination. This is black-letter law in this circuit. So what that leaves us with in this case is a claim of intentional discrimination that has no evidence of discriminatory intent. And actually, as the district court correctly found, the evidence here points in quite the opposite direction. Alcatel-Lucent went through a fairly extensive process here in trying to determine whether or not Mr. Coldwaite was in fact capable of performing his job or not. In brief, Gliori, Berglund, and Dr. Pera, three internal medical professionals, employees of Alcatel-Lucent, sent Mr. Coldwaite to a third party, neutral third party, the physical therapist Jonathan Erickson, for a thorough evaluation. Dr. Pera evaluated the results of that third party evaluation. Based on that and also his knowledge, his medical knowledge and many years of experience as a board certified physician in occupational medicine, placed what he honestly believed were appropriate restrictions on Mr. Coldwaite. Gliori then went back to Jonathan Erickson, the physical therapist, the third party, for further consultation and further opinions from him. Beyond that, Alcatel-Lucent also had Robert Herringer, one of its internal health and safety, occupational health and safety experts, perform a detailed analysis and report based on his witnessing, observing Mr. Coldwaite's peers operating the same machines that Mr. Coldwaite was to operate in his job. Mr. Herringer found that the use of these machines would violate the restrictions that Dr. Pera had put on Mr. Coldwaite, and that there were no viable or safe workarounds for those violations of the restrictions. With that information in hand, several Alcatel-Lucent employees, both Mr. Coldwaite's direct supervisors, representatives from the medical department, representatives from HR, held multiple discussions and conference calls to discuss various possible ways that they could accommodate Mr. Coldwaite to see if there was any way that they could get him back to work. They even took the step of going to of consulting a third-party group that helps employers making reasonable accommodations with employees. Only after that process, which took 4 months and involved 8 to 10 different Alcatel-Lucent employees and 2 outside neutral third-party resources, only after all of that did Alcatel-Lucent reach the honestly held conclusion that it did not believe Mr. Coldwaite could do his job anymore. That's the reason why it terminated his employment. Those are not the actions of a company that has discriminatory animus against people that it perceives to be disabled. Quite the opposite. I'll note also there's other independent reasons we've given in our brief that would support the affirmance of the judgment below. We've argued in a number of ways that Mr. Coldwaite does not fall into the protected categories under the various statutes that he sued us under. I have little to add to what we briefed on that. So if there are no further questions, we will ask the court to affirm the judgment below.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I want to briefly address the Mr. Disharin's contention that returning to work was not the central issue in this case. It was whether there was the intentional discrimination. And again, this you can discriminate. You can intend an act, and it can be a discriminatory act, but you don't have to have this animosity. And this is what the district court appears to have imposed the burden upon the plaintiff to prove. Take, for example, a pregnancy case where the employer really likes the employee but feels that it is in her best interest that she stay home with the child, that he's actually doing her a favor when he terminates her. Does he intentionally terminate her? Yes. Is the action discriminatory? Yes, because it was taken based on her protected characteristic of being pregnant. This action in this case was taken because of Gary Coldwaite's protected characteristic of being disabled, or the perception that he was disabled. And returning to work is a crucial issue. With respect to the credibility issue, I urge you that to take a look at the videotapes. Silly as it seems, there is this credibility issue over what constitutes lifting over your shoulder. And Gary Coldwaite did not testify that he misled the physical therapist. He doesn't believe that there is a lot of lifting over the shoulder involved in his job. What he does is he holds the sheet metal. He reaches over his shoulder. And there is no differentiation with defendants' evaluation of the job to distinguish between overhead lifting and overhead reaching.
I don't want to excite you. The red light's been on for a while.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do apologize. At any rate, to conclude very briefly, we believe that all the issues that have been raised here require this court's reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under